All right, let's go ahead and get started. All right. Thanks everybody for being here tonight. So we'll go ahead and get started with All right, we'll go ahead and get started with introductions on the rap. Ken, go ahead.
Ken Strong, Sportsman's Rep.
Ben Lauder, Public Large.
Rock McMillan, Sportsman's Rep.
AJ Maurer, Agriculture.
Alan White, Agriculture.
George Garcia, Forest.
Joshua Leonard, Sportsman's Rep.
Chris Schmitz, Non-Consumptive Wildlife.
All right, thank you. I'm Chris Marble, representing Public at Large, that chair. So first we'll start with a few procedures. I think everybody here pretty much knows them, but we're going to go over them anyway, just in case. So the process works like this. So the DWR will give their recommendations on any action items. The RAC members will then have the opportunity to ask questions. And then anybody from the public will have the opportunity to ask questions. But no comments at that time, please. Please be sure to state your name. And if you represent an organization, please be sure to call that out. At that time, we will take public comments. Please make sure you fill out a yellow card in the back if you want to give any comments and bring it up prior to the comment period, and we'll call you up. And then from there, we'll turn it over to the RAC for any comments or motions at that point. And just a reminder to all RAC members, aside from any clear conflict of interest, please make sure, especially on a night like this, that everybody is voting. If you're not sure where you'd like to go on an issue, please generate more discussion. Make sure you get the answers that you need to form an opinion.
Chris?
Yes.
And can we clarify that conflict of interest is typically financial?
Well, Ben, it's good you're bringing it up because I see Marty back there.
There Marty, we go.
I love
having to find
explain or define the conflict of interest. But yes, generally speaking, it would be for financial gain. But I'm sure again, Marty would probably have much better explanation, but typically a conflict of interest is something where you would personally gain or an organization you're affiliated with would financially gain from the way you vote. Generally speaking, just for the sake of discussion, if you happen to hunt in a particular area that's up for discussion, that would not be considered a conflict of interest. Okay. All right, moving along. Has everybody had the chance to read the minutes from the last meeting? And if so, could we get an approval of the agenda in the minutes from our last meeting? Any motions?
So moved.
Okay, Brock. 10 seconds. All in favor? Any opposed? Okay, great. It was unanimous. Okay. At this portion of the meeting, we usually do wildlife forward updates. We do not have those updates prepared right now, so if anybody is interested, the video is out on YouTube from the last board meeting, and we will do an update of the last board meeting at the next RAC meeting. All right, turn it over to Jason for regional update.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate that. I do have a few things I'd like to go over this evening. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to go ahead and ask. In the wildlife section, we have a couple of things that RAC members are able to participate on if you're interested in. We have sage grouselet counts underway right now throughout the region, as well as spring range rides and browse surveys ongoing throughout different parts of the this, the region as well. So on either one of those, if you'd like to participate, go ahead and contact me or one of our district biologists, and you can get out on those counts or range rides. Bear season's ongoing, and we've started checking in harvested bears. And then kind of, as I've mentioned in the past, spring depredation is ongoing, but with the weather, it seems slower than normal, slower than in past years. Our habitat section, I've mentioned this quite a bit, but they continue to install wildlife guzzlers this spring. They've recently installed 3 guzzlers in the Drum Mountains west of Delta. These guzzlers will provide reliable water sources for chukar, partridge, pronghorn, mule deer, and other wildlife, but kind of focused on those couple of species. The region staff is currently finishing some of the fiscal year 18 watershed restoration projects this spring. Hope to get those wrapped up soon. And for next fiscal year, starting July, they proposed 30 projects located throughout the region, and those are restoration projects. For my aquatic section, I have a couple of different things going on. They'll be taking eggs to supplement the hatchery brood for cutthroat trout from Littledale Reservoir in mid-June. And we'd like to extend an invitation to all the rack to assist with collection and see the process of collecting those eggs from those fish. And you can contact me again or else our aquatics manager, Chris Crockett, if you're interested to go out on those collections. Dordanelle Reservoir, I think most of you are aware that in 2016 they put together a management plan for the reservoir, and they continue to follow through with that management plan. In early April, they stocked 250,000 3-inch kokanee, and then 18,000 beautiful 12-inch rainbows were stocked today. So we're excited about that. They're hoping for improved survivorship and returns from, or they do have improved survivorship and returns from the 12-inch that were stocked in 2017. And then Splake will be going in later this summer for the first time in Dordanelle Reservoir as well. There's going to be a online angler survey launched in May. If you happen to be one of the randomly chosen participants or recipients of that, we'd surely ask everybody to reply to that. Basically, we'll be evaluating support for regulation changes and other management actions. So if you see that come out or get that email, please respond. A couple of events coming up is the Utah Lake Festival on June 2nd, so about a month away. And then, as always, we have a free fishing day, and this year free fishing day is on June 9th. From our law enforcement section, one of the things that they're concerned about this time of the year is the aquatic invasive species, and particularly in this region, the quagga mussel. In the past several years, they've put a administrative stop at the Daniels Port of Entry, there as it goes up the canyon in the Strawberry, where it's mandatory for watercraft to stop there. That'll start up again this Memorial Day weekend, at the end of this month, and operate until Labor Day. So if you're floating around the state, make sure that you follow the AIS so that you're not, AIS guidelines, so you're not bringing quagga mussels throughout the state. From our region, Sergeant Matt Briggs, who is a sergeant down in Santee County, was nominated and won officer, DWR Officer of the Year, which is pretty exciting for our region. He was also nominated by NWTF as an Officer of the Year and was able to go back to Nashville and represent the state back there. So it was a great honor for Sergeant Briggs, and we're excited for him and proud of him. In our conservation outreach, the annual Salem Pond Fishing Event is going to be held next Tuesday. That's May 8th. Over at Salem Pond, obviously. It's a great event, provides a lot of people who don't typically have an opportunity to go fishing to go out and hook a fish. I've seen many in this room out there on that fishing event, and we'd invite volunteers to come out again to that event, and it is something dedicated hunters can take advantage of and get some hours for coming out and helping the youth. And with that, Mr. Chairman, unless there's any questions, I'll turn the time back over to you.
All right. Thank you, Jason. Any updates? All right, we'll jump right in. Justin Shannon, looks like you're up. This is an informational item for the rights to wear. Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Justin Shannon. I'm the Wildlife Section Chief, and tonight I'm going to give a presentation on wildlife and habitat projects. This is just an informational, no voting will occur. Jump into it. So the purpose of this presentation is twofold. The first is that the Wildlife Board recently asked us to share an overview of how conservation and expo permit funds benefit wildlife and wildlife habitat. So that's the first point. The second one is we've done a lot of exciting work in both of these areas with wildlife management and habitat restoration, but we haven't done a great job of highlighting our successes. And as I've sat on statewide deer committees and elk committees, we talked about some of the good things the division does and how poor of a job we do highlighting that and how conservation and expo permit funds are used. And so that's part of what this is about tonight, is being able to share and present some of this information. I'll present it first and give a statewide overview, and then we'll have the region kind of give a more specific presentation on kind of what they're doing here in the central region. So to begin, big game captures and transplants. Over the last 5 years or so, we've captured 74 bison, mostly on the Henry Mountains and the Book Cliffs, and put radio collars on these animals, understand movements better, and how to manage those populations well. And in addition to that, in the upper right, we've captured 312 pronghorn off the Parker Mountain unit, translocated 237 of them, and then radio collared some animals there on the unit. That's a unit that has peaks and valleys with population growth, and so we wanted to have a better understanding of that herd. And then mountain goat translocations. We started two new populations on the LaSalle and Mount Dutton, and augmented some populations here in the central region on the Nebo. For bighorn sheep, we've captured almost 800 animals over the last 5 years, translocated more than half of them. A lot of this effort has been to build disease profiles on these animals throughout the state, so we can understand what pathogens they've been exposed to and get an overall health assessment of these birds. Our moose captures, done a lot of this on the Wasatch and the UNA's units over the last several years, really good understanding of what the limiting factors of moose are on those units. Elk captures. We captured over 800 elk and translocated about 128, mostly from the Wasatch to the Stansbury area. And this is a photo of Kent Hersey, our big game projects leader, and he's got this ultrasound machine. So not only do we put radio collars on these animals, we can actually get body condition scores and fat measurements. And what that relates to is increased survival and more young and higher survival rates of young and different things like that. And so when animals are in good body condition, they can do better during hard winters and those types of things. And really been a great effort for us. And then deer captures. Caught nearly 4,000 deer, translocated over 1,300. A lot of that's our urban deer program. And really good to have information on our deer. It's helped us in our winter deer feeding decisions, really understanding how these populations are doing on the landscape. If you look at some of the research, I won't get into all this, but in the upper left we have the Wasatch Elk Study. Our friends at BYU have been doing some great research there, and it's completely changed how we manage elk in the state with our private lands only permits and helping us understand how elk adapt to hunting pressure.
You look at the Monroe Fawn Survival Study. This is a study we've done years ago that looked at survival rates from 0 to 6 months of age. And we have good data on fawn survival rates and adult survival rates, and this was another piece to our understanding of big game management. This is kind of neat. This is a video that we put together this is an elk capture that occurred on the Wasatch. We just kind of wanted to show the RAC and the public kind of what our captures look like from a GoPro that's on a helmet. So I don't know if anyone's seen this before, but this is kind of what it looks like. A helicopter will fly over these animals, they'll shoot a net over the animal, it tangles them up, and then this guy is, he's called a mugger. He'll have a radio collar, get down, secure the animal, and then place that radio collar on. Oftentimes they'll secure them, and then we can go and draw blood and do body condition scores and other things like that. It's really kind of neat to see what that looks like. For upland game and waterfowl, some great work occurring there as well. We translocated 5,300 geese throughout the state. A lot of this is on urban golf courses and areas like that. Translocated nearly 5,000 turkeys. And then a lot of quail translocations. And these are kind of neat because it's California quail, Gamble's quail, scaled quail. So we're doing some good work there. We released 50,000 pheasants and 10,000 chuckers. For hunting opportunities, and then moved to 120 sage grouse, mostly to the sheeprocks area. If you look at the upland game monitoring and research, we've done a lot of sage grouse projects over the last 15, 20 years or so. Learned a lot about their biology, their movements, their survival. Also with turkeys, seems like in some parts of the state, turkeys are doing really well. In other parts, we're still trying to grow them and get them established, and our monitoring and research has helped us with that effort. The dusky grouse study, or many might remember them as blue grouse, this is just trying to understand basic biology and ecology with these animals. There's a lot that's unknown in the grouse world with dusky grouse. Chucker research, again, another great project out of BYU and some ptarmigan research that we've been doing as well. If you look at the mammals program, lots of cougar studies have taken place in the state. The most recent one was Dustin Mitchell on the Oker Stansberry. Area, looking at kill rates and movements, pretty neat stuff. Some bear studies, looking at densities throughout the state, and our reproduction monitoring. This gives us an idea of when we see pulses in bear populations, and it helps us with our management. One thing I want to present tonight briefly is just the Utah Migration Initiative. This is really neat. We came out with this about a year ago, and I think the RACs are going to see more on this as an informational, but the purpose of this initiative is to identify, preserve, and enhance movement pathways and corridors for species through strong collaborative partnerships, compelling outreach, and the use of advanced tracking and data management technology. Over the next 30 years, the population in Utah is estimated to double. And as we do that and as we grow, I think it's important that we grow responsibly. And so understanding how wildlife use the landscape, those corridors that they use, is going to be really important. And even on the deer plan, when we wrote this, migration routes were a big part of that, and this helps spur some of those discussions. I want to show a quick video if I can. Oh, That's part of a capture effort that we did on the Poncegon unit this year. And it's one of the first studies in Utah looking at buck movements and survival rates and different things like that. And I don't know if you noticed or not, but one of the bucks down there was covered in velvet. And we're trying to learn more about our cactus buck population as well, which is animals that never shed their antlers. Pretty unique scenario that we have down there. But with this migration initiative, we're able to answer some good questions about wildlife and how they use the landscape, and you'll be seeing and hearing more about this, I'm sure. Moving on from wildlife and wildlife monitoring and research, wanted to move to habitat restoration and improvement. Utah has a watershed habitat restoration partnership that is second to none. There's currently more than 100 partners that have participated in this program over the last 12, 13 years, and the Watershed Restoration Initiative, or WRI, has a few priorities. One is to increase watershed health and biological diversity. The other is to improve water quality and yield. And lastly, to provide opportunities for sustainable uses of natural resources. We want to do good things for our watersheds and the habitat that we have on the mountain. And we feel like by doing that, it'll be good for wildlife, it'll be good for agricultural use, and also just the basic watershed, the health of the system is a good thing as well. This is a snapshot of our WRI website. If you have never been on it or visited it, you should go. It's the Utah Watershed Restoration Initiative. And on the far right, you can see, since we've started this program, we've completed over 1,700 projects, treated almost 1.5 million acres, and spent about $186 million on habitat restoration, with $20 million in kind as well, so other donations. And labor and those types of things. Currently, we have about 281 projects lined up that we're working on, about a quarter million acres, a little more than that, and 60 million in funding. And what we have proposed is another quarter million acres and 45 million in funding. So when it's all said and done, with completed, current, and proposed, it's about 2 million acres and about 300 million in restoration efforts. And that is. So much more than any other state or many of the western states combined. It's just a huge effort that we're doing for wildlife. So what has WRI accomplished? There's kind of two things. There's proactive restoration, which are habitat projects, and I'll show you what some of those look like, making sure we're improving deer and elk habitat. And then there's fire rehabilitation. You look at the Sealy fire and the Bryan Head fire, some of these big Milford Flats. You know, restoring those and making sure they come back healthy is really important. And a thing to note is for every dollar that we use in general fund for these efforts are either leveraged to $5 up to $20 in some cases for fire to restore habitats. And that's important because when you have this many partners, oftentimes what you're looking for is to match. And when you get that match, you can do great things. So how is WRI funded? As you can see, most of it's federal. That's the biggest piece of the pie, which makes sense. A lot of this occurs on federal land. And then second is state. A lot of the state money comes from license sales. You look at the money that comes from Habitat Council and other groups, other things like that. When we buy a hunting and fishing license, a portion of that money goes towards improving habitat. And the third one is the sportsman groups. You look at the conservation permit dollars and the expo permit dollars. It's an important piece of the pie. It's the third biggest on there, and a lot of that money was used as the match, which is really key to what we're doing. And then in addition to that, private landowners, municipalities, mitigation money, counties. I mean, we need everybody to make it work, and it's been a great success. So what are some of the priorities? Some of the priorities are simply improving habitat for wildlife. Oftentimes this is done by battling juniper and pinyon trees and trying to reduce those on the landscape, stream restoration, which is great for our fisheries, and then fire rehab. And I'll give some examples of what this looks like. I don't know if anyone's seen this before. This is a bull hog, and this is a pretty neat machine. It will just chop through these juniper trees pretty aggressively. And I don't know if anyone's ever tried to cut down a juniper tree with a chainsaw, but you will dull your teeth on that very, very quickly, and this makes short work of it. And as it chops it up and spits out the remains, it's really good as it litters the landscape and makes it better for grasses and
forbs or flowers and new shrubs to come in. Because if you look at this right now, that doesn't have a lot of value for wildlife. We have one restoration biologist, and she always says that her goal with the bullhog is to turn bedrooms into kitchens for deer. You know, that's where they go and sleep. It's not where they eat. And she wants to, she always talks about making sure we have more food on the landscape for these animals. It's a pretty neat thing there with the bullhog. Fire restoration. This is a big one, too. And in the on the left side of that screen, there was a Maple Springs fire in 2002, and it was reseeded, and it came back really well. It did good. And then 13 years later, the Black Mountain fire occurred on the right. And as that happened, the previous reseeding effort really helped to keep the Black Mountain fire at bay. And that was good because it reduced the size of the fire. It provided a fuel break, gave firefighters a safe place to work. And it left more forage on the landscape for wildlife and livestock. So then as we have fires, it's not as devastating. Tintic Valley fire rehabilitation. This is an interesting one. Historically, the fire interval was about 35 to 50 years. But by the 1990s, this area was burning 2 to 3 times a decade. And so through some aggressive restoration work, where they wanted to establish some perennial vegetation and limit the cheatgrass, this has turned into a nice area. These bunch grasses that you see in that lower right picture, that's what we're wanting, that type of vegetation on the landscape for wildlife. Chaining. This is pretty neat. I don't know if everyone's seen a chaining before, but this is what it looks like. It's a giant chain pulled between two dozers, and as you can see, it just rips these trees right out the roots, right out of the ground, and then the chains are so heavy as it goes over them, it spits it out and breaks them down really easily, and it also disturbs the soil, which is a good thing, because after a fire like this, as we aerial seed it and put seed on the ground, that seed has a much better chance of germinating and getting those grasses and shrubs and flowers that we need for deer and elk than it would otherwise. So this just makes my heart happy. Tabby Mountain. This is another chaining that we did that isn't related to fire. As you can see on the left, that's what the habitat looked like. Again, very limited value for wildlife. And as we did a two-way chaining on the right, 4 years later, you can see the increase in grasses and sagebrush and those types of things. So as we use these tools to restore habitat, deer and elk do better in these scenarios. Lastly, we have the Kingston Canyon WMA. This is before the habitat treatment. As you can see, we have a river here with a very steep bank, a lot of erosion, a lot of silt and debris that's going into that fishery. And really, it's hard for wildlife even to access portions of the water from there. After the stream bank was restructured and did quite a bit of work down there, this is what it looks like 9 years later, with willows on the side, healthy stream. It's a great fishery, and it's good for wildlife as well. So in summary, the division and our partners, we're trying to improve wildlife management through research and through monitoring, and the Watershed Restoration Initiative has restored habitat at a very aggressive rate, which has benefits to wildlife, livestock, and ecosystems as a whole. And funding for these projects comes from a variety of sources, including a large portion from our hunters, and we're really grateful and appreciative of that. And that's all I have from the 30,000-foot view, and it's okay, we'll turn it over to the regions and let them give a short update on more specific projects.
All right, thank you.
Up from the region.
Mr. Chair and REC members, thank you for this opportunity. My name is Robert Edgel, and I'm the habitat recreation biologist for the Central Region. And we're grateful for this opportunity. We don't get to talk about all the hard work you do very often, and so I'll take a few minutes and just run through quickly some of the projects that we've done in the last year here in the Central Region. So the first one is Little Valley Sheep Rocks Mountain PJ removal. And this is a bull hog and a chaining project that we did just this last year. About 1,000 acres were removed. And in this, along the sheep rocks, it's been a priority area because of the declining sage grouse population. So we're trying to do a lot to benefit that population, as well as its limited entry mule deer area. So it's got a lot of values for different wildlife species, as well as even non-consumptive species. And so doing these projects does a lot of work. So you can see in this picture the PJ or pinyon and juniper trees are encroaching into the sagebrush. And if you do not do anything, then over time you'll see the barren underground as Justin showed us, some areas have become. So we went in this last year, and this shows the area of what we treated. Blue is chaining, the red is bull hog. And here's a quick before and after. So on the left is before the project, looking down through the valley. And then on the right is after. So completely changed how this area looks and really opened it up. Sage grouse don't use areas that have a high density of pinyon and juniper trees. So by doing this, we have created thousands of acres of new habitat for sage grouse. And also there's lots of bitterbrush and sagebrush in this area that'll just take off once, now that they don't have the competition from the juniper trees. Another project that we started doing are man-made beaver dams. We call them beaver dam analogs. And basically, on the sheep rocks, there's no beavers currently, and a lot of the streams, are, like Justin showed, are eroded, and the banks are steep, and really not good for wildlife or livestock. And so we're doing these types of projects to try and get more riparian wetland habitat, wet meadows. By putting these dams into the stream, it slows the water, which causes the sediment to drop, and over time, the bottom of the stream will rise and will bring that floodplain back to where it can flood the during high runoff in the spring. It'll flood the plains inside of the stream and create more vegetation that will benefit livestock, wildlife, as well as is really critical for sage grouse rearing habitat. So this is just one of them that we built, and so the problem. Just showing, we don't want to see this. It's not good for anything. Hard for wildlife to get down in there, and a lot of bad for fish and everything. So basically, we go in and we pound 3-inch, 4-inch stake posts into the ground, into the stream bed, and space it a few feet apart. And then we cut willows from the side, or if we don't have willows, we cut juniper branches and weave them through and place some mud, and it basically looks like a beaver dam. And we have plans to do a lot of work out there. I've been working with the Forest Service on this project. Really grateful for George and Justin and all the help they've been in moving this forward. And we've also started talking with the BLM to plan a bunch more work out there. So there's a lot of opportunity. And water is gold out in this area. And so by doing this, it also makes it so the water lasts longer throughout the year. And we'll have water up in the mountains where wildlife can access it longer. Just a couple of before. Try to make them look like beaver dams as much as possible. But all right, jumping gears. We've done some winter range improvements this year. This one is one we just barely did on our Santa Fe WMA. If you've seen our Santa Fe WMA, we've cleared a bunch of the oak brush a couple years ago, and now we're going into those areas that we opened up and trying to increase the shrub availability in there for big game winter range is crucial for them. We planted about 1,000 shrubs with partnering with many sportsman groups to fund that, and volunteers and dedicated hunters to come out and plant. And then we also did a project in Traverse Mountain. It's a really great opportunity to reach out to the community and educate. We had about 200 high school students come and help with that. And really a great opportunity to teach them about the importance of these habitats for big game. And also on our Timpanogos WMA, we planted about 1,000 shrubs and critical areas for, you know, we've lost a lot of our winter range, and so anything we can do to improve it is critical. Another interesting project, as you drove down here, you may have seen out in Provo Bay, there's not as much Phragmites as there used to be. We've been spraying it, and then we go in with these machines you see on the left and smashing it, and we'll be doing that for the next 3 years, and hopefully over time we'll be able to remove that Phragmites and increase the water and important wetland vegetation for waterfowl and many other wildlife species in this area. So it's kind of a new project, and if you haven't seen it, go ahead and go out there and check it out. Another thing, you saw Justin's video of our bull hog. That's a machine that we have in our region, and it's really, you know, on our WMAs, it's been able to save us a lot of money by having a machine ourselves and doing some of these smaller projects, about $130 an acre. So it's a lot cheaper, and we've done a lot of work, about 2,200 acres since 2012. This is a picture of our Bird's Eye WMA. We've also been working on the van this last year, and made such a great difference over time, and we've reseeded it as well, and so we should increase the available vegetation there. This is a cool project that we just did this last week with a partnership with the Forest Service, Sheep Creek prescribed fire just up Spanish Fork Canyon here, and burned about 400 acres of, you know, conifer, aspen, summer range habitat. So that's really where we, you know, an area that we also want to target moving forward is more summer range. We've been shown to be really crucial for winter survival of big game. So we really are thankful to the Forest Service for getting this done, and hope to do more of this kind of work. And sportsmen groups really helped to fund this, so we're really appreciative of that. Justin talked a little bit about wildfire rehabilitation. We've continue to see a lot of fires. This last year was really busy. There's just a list of some of the fires we had this last year, about 50,000 acres. And so it really, we jump on it in the fall and try to get out, plan a project to rehab these areas with seed, as well as, like Justin was showing, we'll, in some areas we're going with a chain afterwards to incorporate that seed into the ground and knock over these trees, and in some areas it can be really beneficial for sage-grass if we can get that vegetation growing back, as well as by knocking down these trees, and then it's just critical to get, so we don't just get a sage or a cheatgrass monoculture afterwards, so it's essential that we do. And then lastly, we've been putting a lot of guzzlers out there. We've started doing a lot of, more of these smaller upland game 500-gallon guzzlers, but they're also, as you can see, very important for mule deer. Love them, and where some areas where there's not a huge demand from big game, it can be really, they can last all the water that they need. And so we've done a lot of that, and we've also done some big game guzzlers as well. And been busy and real appreciative of all the volunteers and sportsmen that helped to get these built and put them again. Thank you.
All right. Thanks, Robert.
I'll try to be quick. We've done a lot of awesome things here in the Central Region in wildlife, and some of it may look redundant to what Justin has just presented, and that wasn't intentional. Just a lot of the cool things that are going on in the state are going on right here in our backyard, and we're kind of excited to have all of that take place. We mentioned mountain goats on the Neva. We were able to move mountain goats, you know, augment that population. Recently, when the biologist flew, we were able to see a higher amount of goats than we have in the past, and as a result, we recommended in the Wildlife Board recently passed a permit increase of over double. So we're seeing good things there that are resulting with more tags on the ground and people seeing more goats on the mountain. As mentioned earlier, we put sheep on the Stansberry Mountain. We had a fairly significant die-off on the mountain that completely eliminated the sheep that we had there. And we had the ability this last winter to put them back. We're excited about that. We're excited about the potential to monitor them moving forward. And people are reporting seeing them. They're excited that they're back and hope that we can continue the success there and get a tag again here in the future to get sportsmen out utilizing. Elk on the Stansberries, this was kind of fun in two ways. We had an increase of objective on Stansberry Mountain, and we had a kind of a increased depredation load in Heber City with an objective of elk that was really high on the Wasatch Mountains. And so we were able to capture the elk out of Heber City and put them onto the Stansberries. And every one of them, as you see in the picture, were either fitted with a telemetry collar or a sight collar, and the elk are doing really well there. A lot of people are seeing both the bulls and cows, and so far that has been, they're staying right where we wanted them to go, and there's a lot of elk habitat there for them to use. Urban deer translocation. We have a lot of this in our region, maybe a little bit more than anywhere else in the state. I know that's no surprise when you look around us where we're at. But we've been able to move deer out of Harriman, Provo, Taylorsville, Linden, and move them to places throughout the state. And it's been fun to study that and to also be involved in helping some of the cities reduce their deer populations. We look around, Harriman is one that I think has been a success with this program. As we try to trap the deer out in the middle of the summer, we've seen a decrease in deer auto collisions. We also seen the population and the number of complaints go down. As mentioned before, the Wasatch Front has been a part of this moose study and reproduction study. It's been a fun one to be a part of, and a graduate student from Utah State University should be wrapping that up with the results, but it's been fun to have that in our backyard as well. We have the elk movement and survival study. This has been instrumental, and I know a lot of you here in the RAC have been part of this, as we noticed that a lot of the elk are spending a lot of the times during the hunt on private land, and it's helped us to get creative and find a different tool and shift to private lands only permits. Changed a little bit the way that we hunt elk, and has been a good tool and a great study to be part of. Our deer movement and survival study. Many of you have participated in this as well, but we have locations in San Pete County on the Wasatch and out in Tooele. And turkey translocations. We talked about this quite a bit as well. We have some of the areas in our region that are thriving with turkeys and some areas that could improve. And so we've been part of both sending turkeys within our region to other locations to augment those populations, and we've been sending them to other regions as well. As we've, over the last few years, trapped, you know, well over 1,000 birds within our region. We mentioned the sheep rocks translocation. There's a study going on as we translocate birds from both Fox Elder County and from the Parker Valley. It's been a fun project to be a part of as well. This was mentioned before. We have this going on in a couple of our districts as well, our bear reproduction monitoring. This one's fun. As you went through, I could have mentioned this before. You notice which pictures of mine are like the bottom left. It's a real clear and crisp photo, and then you have others that are just beautiful. But I wanted to put that picture in, as I don't know if any of you have been part of the Penraise pheasant release that we have. We released quite a few birds in our our region. It has been awesome. But you get the opportunity, if you can, go down to the Utah Lake Wetland Preserve, and you see youth every single day of the week taking advantage of the thousands of birds that get released there. And it is really an awesome opportunity, and that is all that I have. We went pretty quick. We have a large agenda, and we overlapped on a lot of that, but we have a lot of great things going on, and a lot of that credit goes to the sportsmen we have and the RAC for helping us out on that. So I want to tell you thank you for everything you do to help us on that regard.
Thank you.
Sorry, folks. It's dark here. I can't see the board.
No worries, Marty.
Okay, my name is Marty Bushman. I'm an assistant attorney general at Thine for the Division of Wildlife Resources. And I guess I had to warn you right off that this presentation is not as photo-rich as the previous ones. In fact, it has no photos. But anyway, it's kind of hard to find an interesting photo about legal issues. But this is talk to you a little bit on an informational item only to talk about county resource management plans. In 2016, the Utah legislature enacted statute that directed counties to prepare resource management plans that dealt with their individual county. And these plans were designed and are designed to address a whole wide variety of land management issues within each county, but they also include areas that are supposed to cover things like predator control, wildlife, fisheries, and threatened and endangered species. And it's raised some concerns of where these county resource management plans fit in with the division's responsibilities, the Wildlife Board and RAC's responsibilities to manage wildlife as well. And in order to kind of answer that question for you, I think it's best to give you a little overview of the authorities, the statutory authorities of the Division of Wildlife Resources, RACs, and Boards. So this will be pretty text-intensive, but we'll go through it quickly. In code, the Division of Wildlife Resources is designated as trustee and custodian of protected wildlife. Our wildlife within the state, including whether it's on private or public lands or private or public waters, falls within the jurisdiction of the Division of Wildlife Resources. And subject to the policymaking authority of the Wildlife Board, the Division is directed to protect, propagate, manage, conserve, and distribute protected wildlife throughout the state. Regional advisory councils and Wildlife Board also have statutory directives. The councils are directed to hear broad input, including recommendations, biological data, and information regarding the effects of wildlife, to gather information from staff, the public, and government agencies, and finally, to make recommendations to the Wildlife Board in advisory capacity. The Wildlife Board, on the other hand, is charged to establish the policies best designed to accomplish the purpose and fulfill the intent of all laws pertaining to wildlife and the preservation, protection, conservation, perpetuation, introduction, and management of wildlife. And then the Wildlife Board, in carrying out these policy directives, is directed to recognize that wildlife is an essential to a healthy environment, recognize the economic impact of wildlife on private property and local economies, seek to balance the habitat requirements of wildlife with the social and economic activities at hand, and to recognize the social and economic values of wildlife and seek to maintain wildlife on a sustainable basis. And lastly, to consider the recommendations of the RAC. This is the statute framework for an enabling language for the division, the Wildlife Board of the RAC, in terms of managing wildlife in Utah. Now, there are some very specific directives with some topics, for instance, with translocation. The division is authorized to transplant big game turkeys, wolf, sensitive species, among other species, but these species have to do it in accordance with a plan that identifies proposed transplant sites, vetted rural potentially affected landowners, local government officials, and is submitted to the RAC of the affected region for recommendation to the Wildlife Board, and lastly approved by the Wildlife Board. So this is the statutory process that's set out for the division's efforts in transplanting big game turkeys, wolves, and sensitive species. Wildlife management plans are also an activity that the legislature has given some specific direction to the division. The statute states that when the division prepares these plans for deer and elk units, and the statute only talks about deer and elk units, although the division prepares plans for a lot of other species, and they follow the same format. But when they do management plans, they need to establish a target herd size objective, consider the range, carrying capacity of the unit, seek to balance relevant multiple uses of the range, seek and consider input from federal and state lands managers, private landowners, sportsmen, and ranchers, and plans presented to the RACs for recommendation to the board, and then ultimately the plan must be approved by the Wildlife Board. These are the basic statutory components of wildlife management in Utah. Now, in 2016, when the legislature directed counties to prepare resource management plans, they were given a whole wide variety of topics to cover, including wildlife, fisheries, predators, and threatened endangered species. However, it was very clear that the legislature did not intend those county resource management plans to control or supersede the division's statutory authority to manage wildlife within the state. One of the very last sections of that statute stated, quote, nothing in this part may be construed to limit the authority of the state to manage and protect wildlife under Title 23, Wildlife Resources Code of Utah. There, an expression by the legislature saying, you know, whatever we're asking the counties to do in these plans, it's not intended to interfere with or supersede the authority of the state under Title 23. Now, some of these county resource management plans, which I believe all have been completed now, express positions on wildlife management matters, including topics such as population objectives, management plans, and translocation. The division elects the Wildlife Board should carefully consider and weigh these positions when making recommendations, decisions that implicate them. But the RMPs do not control or bind the state in exercising its wildlife management authority under Title 23. This idea in the legislature is quite clear that the RMPs are not intended to limit the authority of the state to manage wildlife. The state also prepared a resource management plan this past year. It was adopted by the legislature this past legislative session, and it also addresses predator control, wildlife, bird fisheries, and threatened endangered species. And although the plan identifies broad conservation objectives relative to wildlife, it reaffirms and recognizes the division's authority to manage wildlife and the RAC and the Wildlife Board process for developing policy. And part of the plan, it states, quote, the process for determining the balance among competing uses and establishing the best fishery and wildlife management policies is declared in state law through the RAC and Wildlife Board process. So, in summary of this, the takeaways we have is the divisions, the Division Advisory Council's Wildlife Board should evaluate and seriously consider wildlife-related objectives in county resource management plans when making management decisions that deal with the policies that are set forth in the plan. However, the final decision is made pursuant to the Wildlife Code, which sets forth the process So we will continue our same processes and have we done prior to these plans, only the plans will be something else we can consider now. And that concludes what I have to say. If there's any questions, I'd be happy to respond.
Thanks, Marty. I think Justin raised the bar with video, so.
Yeah, no, it's, I'm sorry. It was a kind of a dearth.
Do you have any questions? Black members? There's a lot of information. Thanks, Marty. Appreciate it. Maybe for a minute, let everybody wake up for just a sec. Alright, jump into wild turkey recommendations and rule amendments. Jason Robinson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I am Jason Robinson. I'm the Upland Game Coordinator for the Division of Wildlife based out of Salt Lake City. I'm going to be presenting some wild turkey recommendations here tonight. So just a little bit of background before we jump into things. So a year ago, we presented a recommendation for a three-year guidebook for Upland Game and Turkey that went through the RAC and board process and was approved. So we're just finishing year one of that three-year recommendation process. However, we evaluated some things relating to turkeys and wanted to take some time and thought that these were big enough issue and time-sensitive, so we wanted to bring them through even though we're in the middle of that process. So essentially what we're doing is most of the things that are in place for upland game and turkey hunting have already been approved. We're just asking for a couple of tweaks specific to turkeys. Turkey populations in Utah are doing fantastic. It's a real success story, wildlife success story, and we love to tote that fact. However, there are some concerns in various parts of the state. We've done so well that we have turkeys in some areas that are beyond both mostly social carrying capacity, getting large concentrations of turkeys. That photo that I've included there is up in Mendon City in Cache Valley, and that's a photo that showed up in Deseret News, kind of showing some of the issues that municipalities and landowners are facing. And so DWR wants to take some management actions to help address some of these turkey issues. So again, we're recommending a few adjustments for years two and three of the three-year guidebook, and then at the end of that, we would then bring this back again with the other upland game and turkey recommendations. DWR believes that these actions will increase hunting opportunities and help alleviate some of those turkey concerns in some parts of the state. So just a little bit more background on where we are with turkey hunting and management. So we have three performance targets that we look at each year. We look at hunter success rates, and we like those to be greater than 20%. We look at hunter crowding on a 1 to 5 scale, and we like that to be less than or equal to 4. And then we also look at hunter satisfaction on a 1 to 5 scale, and we want that to be greater than 2. These are the management parameters we've had in place nearly a decade. What we've been evaluating hunt for a long time. So looking at the spring turkey permit data, the yellow line there shows the total number of permits. Of note, in 2010 was the first year we offered the over-the-counter season, and so you see a big spike there in the number of permits. We saw kind of a drop-off. People realized that turkey hunting is pretty hard. But over time, those hunters have come back and really enjoyed turkey hunting, and we've seen an increase in the number of turkey hunters, and harvest kind of follows those trends with the number of hunters. So looking at spring hunter success, the three-year average hunter success rate has been 32%. So we are exceeding our target of greater than 20% for hunter success. Looking at spring hunter crowding, the three-year average hunter crowding is 2.2. So we are less than our target of 4, which is good. Of note there, the blue line shows again the number of hunters afield. As we've increased the number of hunters afield, hunters are not feeling any more crowded, which is a good thing. So we can put more people out on the landscape, and hunters are dispersing themselves well. Spring hunter satisfaction, the three-year average hunter satisfaction is 3.9, so we're exceeding our target of 2, and you can see overall hunters are very satisfied. So what this shows us is the spring hunting season, hunters aren't crowded, they're being successful, and satisfaction is high, which is all the things we're hoping for. Switching over to fall wild turkey, so we've had 4 years with a fall wild turkey hunt. You can see the black line is the total permits sold for the hunt, and then the yellow line is total harvest. A lot of that variation is due to weather, heavy snow years, that kind of thing. Looking at fall wild turkey hunter success, so you have the black line is hunter afield, and the yellow line is hunter success. You'll notice that hunter success varies from about 50 to 70%. So hunter success on these fall hunts is very high. And then looking at fall wild turkey satisfaction and crowding, the black line shows satisfaction. Again, right around 4, hunters are very satisfied with the fall hunt. And then crowding, there the yellow line, the hunters are not feeling crowded at all. They're at the bottom end of the scale. So again, all turkey hunters are being successful, they're satisfied, and they're not feeling crowded. So all of us management parameters are working quite well. So jumping into the recommendations that we would like to see that will help with some of these areas where we want to focus some more harvest, we've got two recommended changes here. We would like to, and again, maybe worth stating one more time, the main objective of these fall hunts is to reduce human-turkey conflict areas. Fall hunts can reduce turkey population, and so it's a tool that we use to accomplish that goal. So we're not recommending any changes to the fall hunt structure. For the most part, it's working very well. One thing we would like to do is extend the maximum date, so be able to start the hunts a little bit earlier, as early as October 1. And then we would like to allow up to 3 wild turkeys to be taken by an individual hunter per year. And those would be either sex permits. And of note, the fall turkeys are a specific area set aside each year. And then we also cap the number of permits available, even though they're sold over the counter. There is a maximum number of permits sold. Looking at Rule 65754, taking wild turkeys, we would like to recommend a change to the shotgun size and shot diameter. We would recommend that hunters be able to use any shotgun firing shot BB or smaller diameter. We want hunters to decide what best shotgun works for them and what ammunition works best for them. There's a lot of advancements in shot and non-toxic shot and stuff like that. So let hunters decide what works best for them. We would like to recommend allowing rimfire weapons on fall turkey hunting. We believe that this will increase the effective range, hopefully increase the success rates. And then the main reason is allow people that don't traditionally hunt with shotguns for turkey, that may just have a rimfire at home, to get introduced to turkey hunting and the sport. A lot of these fall hunts overlap Thanksgiving, so people might even be able to harvest a bird for their Thanksgiving dinner. And then we would like to simplify the number of permits available. Right now, it's pretty hard to decipher how many permits a person can have, and there's actually no limit to the number of permits. So we'd like to simplify the language to be 1 spring permit and then 3 fall permits per hunter. Conservation permits would be an addition to these permits for the 1 and 3, 1 spring, 3 fall. Looking at Rule 65769, turkey depredation, again, we would like to simplify the number of permits to 3 per hunter. So an individual hunter could have a combination of fall general season, depredation, or control permit vouchers. But it'd be a cap at three in any combination of those. The landowner control permits, these are permits we issue to landowners that are having nuisance and actually depredation problems on their private land. Those landowner control permits would be in addition to the three fall permits. So what we're trying to do there is allow hunters to get in there and harvest these birds that are causing nuisance or depredation. Also, it's important to note that we will continue with the trap and transplant efforts where that tool is useful and where it can be applied. It's a very good tool. It's helped us fill our turkey population, so we'll still utilize that. But it doesn't work everywhere all the time, and so this allows us to have a few more tools and provide some more hunting opportunities. Thank you.
All right, thank you. All right, the RAC members, any questions?
Explain a little bit more on your landowner control permits. Are these permits that are given to the landowners or just giving out to applicants, or what's the process?
So what we have a process in place that if a landowner has turkeys causing damage on their private property, they can get in contact with the Division of Wildlife. We'll assess the situation, come up with a plan for that particular property. And under that plan, a landowner can be issued two permits to take two either sex birds on their property. If that doesn't alleviate the problem, then the same landowner can actually be issued control permit vouchers, and those vouchers can then be transferred to individuals the landowner wants on their property. Those vouchers are turned in for a turkey hunting permit, and then they can harvest a bird of either sex on the landowner.
And the number of vouchers then would be just based on circumstances, I think.
Yeah, it's 10% of the population on the land. It's under the plan with a maximum of 15.
What kind of conflict do you see in the turkey land? What were the differences?
We've had issues with all of those. I don't know the percentages off the top of my head. We deal with, so there's nuisance, which is a lot of time droppings on the sidewalk, scratching in beds. But we also have issues where there's actual damage to crops or bale hay or something like that. And so we have areas throughout the state that have varying degrees of each of those.
Okay, any other questions? Good. A couple questions. First, I was just looking through the guidebook, and I saw in your presentation you had mentioned there's areas where you can hunt the fall turkeys in all five regions. I recall this just started in the southern region.
If I said that, I misspoke. There's three regions that are currently have a fall season.
Okay, and what regions are those?
The northern, southern, and southeast.
And where do you find the areas for those? I didn't see it in the guidebook.
We publish those on our web page. Okay. In the fall.
All right. Next question. I've received a few emails about concerns about being able to hunt them in the fall with a rimfire. I think primary concern is a safety issue, which I don't necessarily agree with, but just wondering if you can speak to that real quick.
Yeah, we've had lengthy discussions on the safety. Obviously, we want hunters to be safe, first and foremost. With the fall hunt and allowing rimfire, what we essentially kind of came up with was we currently have multiple hunts for varying species going on throughout the fall that allow for rimfire, shotgun, high-powered rifles, muzzleloader, archery equipment. And one of the things that's been brought up too is Hunter Orange. An upland game hunter here in the state of Utah is not required to wear Hunter Orange. So we currently have hunters out there without Hunter Orange, pursuing species without, while there's other hunts going on. And so ultimately what we decided was, as with is always the case whenever a hunter or anyone firing, discharging a firearm, it's up to that individual to make sure that what they're firing at is safe and make sure of your target and what's beyond it as well. So hopefully hunters are being safe and taking it upon themselves to do that.
Sure. And as I understand, these fall hunts are typically designed to deal with depredation issues or conflict issues in the 22, or sorry, the rimfire is essentially an additional tool to help with the success of dealing with those issues, correct?
Correct, yeah.
Perfect, thanks.
All right, any other questions? All right. Okay, we'll turn it over to the public. Any questions out there on this? Lori?
Troy Justin, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. Jason, can you give me a number of how many birds are actually transplanted on an annual basis?
Yeah, it varies a lot from year to year, depending on how severe the winter is. But in general, we're moving anywhere from usually around a low of 600 birds. This year, we moved over 2,100 birds statewide. So we're still trapping and moving quite a few birds.
As far as areas that are void of turkeys or potential release sites for turkeys, what does the state look like? Do we got room to put a bunch more turkeys, or are we getting close to being saturated?
We definitely have areas we can put more turkeys. There are areas of the state that we feel are saturated, but we do have areas that we can continue to put turkeys, and that's the intent, is to keep moving turkeys into those areas and expanding our turkey population.
On these turkey captures, whatever you want to call them, used to big game, but is this something that has to be manned by the Division of Wildlife Resources, or do nonprofit groups get involved? How do these captures work?
So we involve groups. SFW has been involved. NWTF has been involved. So we involve groups. We just saw one in Marty's presentation. To transplant turkeys requires additional efforts. Similar to big game, we have to have a plan in place, a translocation site. And so often our folks are the ones that are releasing the birds, but we've volunteered quite a bit in the past.
Thank you. All right, any other questions? All right, moving to the comment portion. Mike Pritchett. Did you get your name right?
Yeah.
All right. Mike Pritchett, I'm representing myself. A lot of you that know me, I've been involved with wild turkeys since the day they came here in Hobble Creek. Me and my brother let them go here. Had a big to-do with it, and then been involved with them for, when did they come here, 91? In 1991, and I was involved in Turkey Federation, the president, and everything for years and years in Sports, Fish, and Wildlife. And back in the day, I remember that we talked about over-the-counter turkey sales, and I personally, being the president of NWTF, I didn't think that day would ever come, and there it is, and it came. So when Jason called me on this recommendation of this fall hunting and three turkeys and shooting with 22s, it was just another day of, like, wow. And turkeys have done very successful in Utah. And the division working with all of us, Sports, Fish, Wildlife, NWTF, is, numbers are just phenomenal. Opportunity for you, disabled, and everybody to get out there and opportunity to get them. So I guess I was a little awestruck about the 22 issue, like Ben was talking, but again, it's got to be a tool to harvest them and do it ethically, and right, so I guess it's another tool in the toolbox, so a little bit split, but I guess in the end of the day, I support the division. I think it's a good recommendation. I mean, it's just more hunting opportunity, and for spending my whole entire adult life in turkeys, and it's pretty amazing to see in Utah. I mean, I just got back from Nebraska last night at midnight, and it's pretty phenomenal that, I mean, Utah has what we do, and being able to go over the counter, and I never thought I'd personally see the day, and it's amazing. So good work by the division, the RAC, I mean, working together, it's just another thing. Jason knows, I mean, manpower health-wise, I mean, SFW, NWTF, there's millions, hundreds of volunteers, people that'll help transplant birds. I drove personally to back to Kansas and picked up birds and brought them back to the division. So there's a lot of good people, and it's a great program. So kudos to them. Thank you. Thank you. Wayland Pritchett.
Kind of following suit of what Mike said, it's amazing to see the opportunity and the chance and that we have here in Utah, see the populations of birds grow to the numbers that they are now. One thing, in my opinion, I find a little kind of unfair is I think by increasing the tag permits for the fall makes it a little bit more unfair for the spring hunters. I feel the group's kind of divided a little bit between those that hunt them in the fall and those that hunt them in the spring. I would personally like to see it maybe even level out a little bit more to where somebody could purchase two in the spring and two in the fall. I know looking at Jason's data and information, success rate's a little bit lower in the spring. I think, though, to kind of even it out, make it a little bit more fair, to allow somebody that's hunting in the spring be able to either purchase a second permit for these areas that are having issues with the birds, especially somebody that's in the northern region, southern or southeastern region, has either drew a limited entry permit or purchased a general season permit, be able to purchase one of these second permits.
All right, thank you. All right, Troy Justison.
Troy Justison, Sports and Fish and Wildlife. Rumor is that Mike Pritchett actually gobbles when he sleeps. You'll find no more passionate turkey guy there is. We appreciate what Mike's done in this program. Typically, when SFW takes a position on items like this, it goes before a fulfillment committee, which are 17 chapters throughout the state. And due to the time constraints, we haven't had the ability to discuss this, but based upon what I've heard, we would support the division's recommendations. I would only ask that we still don't lose track of being, the opportunity we have to move these birds. So we use this as a tool as a worst-case scenario to go into places and bring down populations if we can't get in there and trap them to move them to different parts of the state. But we commend the division. 2,100 birds in a year. That's phenomenal. Thank you.
That's right. Clint Peterson.
Clint Peterson, representing myself. I was pretty excited when I first read these. I've never come out to one of these meetings. I've never participated in anything like this. I haven't been a turkey hunter. I hunted them once last year. So when I saw this, for me, what it was, is I've got daughters, right? They're not big guys like these guys. So when I saw these recommendations, one of my daughter's favorite things are a little pink camo Rimfire 22. I asked her, is this something that you would like to do? She's never been interested in hunting with me before, you know, but she loves to shoot that little gun, and so that was pretty exciting for her, you know. I remember being a kid trying to shoot a 12-gauge, 20-gauge shotgun, you know, and it was too big for me, and so it gave me that, like, being afraid of shooting a gun, you know. This gives an opportunity to shoot a little 410 shotgun, a lot more manageable. You know, I think it's a really good idea. It seems like a pretty cool opportunity to get some of these younger hunters more involved, and I was pretty excited about it.
Thanks for your comments. Appreciate it. Okay, I'm out of cards. Any other comments? All right, I'll turn it back to the rack for discussion or motion.
Again. Jason, I got one question for you. My concern a little bit is with the Rimfire, is are we going to have, first question, are we going to have a lot of wounded birds that run off and die? And second question is, I think about 90% of the hunters are capable of using the Rimfire cartridge when hunting. I think there's 10% that will go out there and at 150 yards see a decoy and open up on it when there's a hunter very close by, and that's my concern on that. Could you give me a little bit more information or opinion?
Yeah, so with the wounding, we hope not. We hope that hunters are being conscious of the distance The same can be said of a shotgun or archery equipment. You know, you need to know your effective range and be efficient at that distance. I think that the rimfire shouldn't have a lot of wounding loss. You know, it's a heavier bullet than, you know, like a 4 or 6 shot pellet. And hopefully hunters are staying within their effective range. That's the most important thing for that. And what was the second question you asked?
Well, those were the two questions. The second one was with rimfire. I just know that there's people out there, and I'll bring in big game. They're no more than just a rifle off the shelf, and they see a deer at 800 yards, and they're going to shoot at it. And I feel like there could be people out there, and there probably is people out there, that would see a turkey at 150 yards and think, I can get it with this rimfire, knowing that there's a guy somewhere up there, and they don't realize they're decoys. I mean, I've had so many people shoot duck decoys out from under me, taking a shot up there and start to send lead around, and that concerns me.
And most people aren't using decoys as much as they do in the spring hunting. It's maybe less common for fall hunters to use decoys. But again, I hope those hunters are making sure of their target and what's beyond it.
Hey, Jason, do you have any... Do you guys have any case studies that you considered from other states doing something similar?
Yeah, so Colorado has a fall turkey hunting season, and they've had it for a long time. We talked with a retired biologist who's now with NWTF, and he did law enforcement for, I think, 31 years there in Colorado, and he couldn't recall any incidences with the fall, any accidents with fall turkey hunting. But he could, unfortunately, there were a few in the spring, so... it seems like, for the most part, it's pretty safe.
Okay. Thank you, Jason. Chris, to add to that, I know Wyoming allows hunting with a turkey with any weapon. You can shoot them with a 30-06 if you want.
Okay. All right. Thanks, Ben. Any more discussion?
Follow-up question. So when it's a depredation case and crops are damaged, do farmers get reimbursed for that crop damage, or do they just get tags to reduce the birds on the property?
They're not reimbursed, and so we try and either trap and transplant the birds, that's been our primary tool, or if we need to, we'll go in and issue permits to harvest birds.
Yeah. And so then, a different question. What was the sort of the catalyst for making this change now? Because I'm sure you were part of that process to get the rules to be the same for the last 2 years. So what's the tipping point now that we need to address this now, not before years?
So I mentioned we moved over 2,100 turkeys this year. That's a record number of birds. That's a big strain on our personnel and manpower. So we wanted to reduce that impact. There's populations in Cache Valley that are at the point that we need to start taking action. And turkey populations... They're upland game, so their populations can grow very, very quickly. And so we didn't want to wait a couple of years. If we have a couple of good springs and the right conditions, those populations can grow very, very quickly and make it much harder to address 2 years from now than it would be today.
And then I guess my last question, and it speaks to the gentleman's point. The one by shooting 3 turkeys in the fall where they're down on the flats, you're reducing hunter success and harvest rates in the spring.
We don't think so. We'll monitor that very carefully. So we'll, you know, do those surveys to make sure that hunter success rates are staying above those targets. In most of these areas where we're doing these fall hunts, there's an abundance of turkeys, an overabundance in many cases. And so we feel like there should be still plenty of birds left for the spring hunt.
George?
I got a question. So when the northern southeast, is there a potential fall season still to the central region, and any to deal with that overabundance of turkeys on the southeast?
I believe so. Maybe Riley, if you wanted to address that for here in the central region.
Yeah, I think moving forward, there are some places that we would like to see a fall turkey hunt in the central region. I think primarily it would be on private lands and help with some of those overpopulated areas. And I guess to speak to that as well, it's not necessarily going to slow down our trapping efforts either. There are places in our region that we're not going to be able to trap and, or have a hunt. So trap and relocate is still going to take place, but we do have plans to implement a hunt or propose a hunt for the Rapid Group.
I have a comment. So, I grew up in Utah, but I lived in Kansas during the 1990s, and then I moved to Minnesota for the first 8 years of 2000s. And we went through the same thing in both those states, from almost no turkeys while I was there to coming out of theirs. So any tool that we can give the division to manage those populations where there are problems, I think is a good thing.
Agreed. Any other discussion? We have a motion?
Go ahead, Ben.
Move to accept the division's proposals recommendation as presented.
All right, thanks, Ben. Do we have a second?
George seconds.
All right, all in favor? Put them up there for a second. Can you capture it? All right, we're going there. That must be. Did you get that? I haven't been asked for a post yet. I want to make sure you got the fours first.
All right, all those opposed?
Okay, I'm going to close. That motion passes. Thank you. Appreciate you. All right, move on to the Coyote Bounty Program. Jayla. Did I get that right?
Jayla?
Jayla. Okay, I'm going to try to get that right. All right.
Thank you for letting me speak tonight on this. I'm Jayla Walden. I am the Predator Management Specialist for the Division. So I will be discussing the proposed rule amendments to Rule R-657-64, which pertains to the Predator Control Program. So a little bit of background on the program. It was initiated in 2012 under the Mule Deer Protection Act. The purpose of the program is to protect non-predatory wildlife in Utah, specifically geared towards protecting mule deer. So the way the program works is legislation allocates a set amount of money every year to the program. Typically it's $500,000 per year. And then that money is used to provide a cash incentive of $50 per coyote to any participant who properly documents a coyote and submits it through the division at designated check-in times. So when participants are turning in coyotes, they are required to record the date, the location, the sex, and the method of take of each coyote that they submit. And to become a participant, individuals of the public must take a education course that we provide for them online. So a quick overview of the proposed changes. The first is we recommend requiring a COR to be able to participate in the program. Number two, we recommend standardizing the condition that we accept samples in. Number three, we are recommending being able to alter the payments based on how close we come to exhausting our budget for the previous fiscal year. And then the fourth recommendation is requiring the use of an electronic application, which would replace the paper compensation forms that are currently used. So the first recommendation is requiring a certificate of registration. This isn't really going to make a big difference for participants. Basically, what's going to happen is they go online, they take their education course, and it prints off this sheet that you see here on the left, and it's going to replace that registration number down in the bottom right-hand corner with a COR number. The big change that participants are going to see is they're going to have to renew this every They're going to have to renew annually, so every 365 days. And this is actually already a regulation or a regulation in our policy right now. We just haven't been enforcing it for the program. We're trying to keep this as simple as possible, and so we're not requiring any additional paperwork, and we're also going to waive any fees, which are generally associated with the COR. And then the reason we're changing it to a COR instead of a registration number is to help us be able to manage the program better. And with the renewal process, if it's a COR, we can deny the renewal for participants who aren't meeting the requirements or aren't following the guidelines like we have requested of them. So the next recommendations we are making refer to the conditions that participants submit samples in. First off, the rule states that anyone claiming payment must have taken the coyotes that they're submitting, and we want to replace the word taken throughout the policy to the word killed. And this is because there's a lot of ambiguity that revolves around the word taken. For one, it can be used as considered, it covers roadkill, which we're trying to reduce submissions of, and we don't want to be accepting roadkill because that doesn't benefit our mule deer because the coyote would have died regardless. And then on top of that, the word killed is determinant, and so So replacing taken with killed helps our law enforcement officers hold cases that would otherwise be dismissed over verbiage, because taken could be viewed as taking from another individual and submitting for it as their own. And then we want to standardize what condition we accept our samples in. When guys come into our check-in stations, they are required to submit the scalp with both ears attached and the lower jaw. Most participants are already doing this in a condition that's acceptable, but from time to time, our technicians and biologists have a difficult time identifying what species is actually coming into us, and so we encourage not having maggots or other carrion organisms on the samples, and they also cannot be rotten or spoiled, because otherwise it makes it difficult to identify as a coyote. And then the last thing, the current rule states that the jaw must have the canines intact, and we just want to include the premolars on that, because since the beginning of the program, we've been collecting a premolar tooth, so we're just changing the rule to match our management actions. The next proposal we are making is having the ability to alter the payment based on where we are in relation to the budget in the previous fiscal year. So what this would mean is, say this fiscal year we exhaust all of our appropriated budget, then in the following year we would reduce payments for each coyote by $5. And say that we reach our maximum spent, we exhaust our entire budget again, we would then reduce it down $5 more, so it would be $40 that fiscal year. And then if we stay below our budget, we'd bump it back up in $5 increments up to the maximum of $50. And this is really just a proactive approach to managing the budget. You can see on the graph on the left-hand side, we've had an upward trend in how many coyotes are being submitted, and so our payments continue to increase. And we don't, in the rule, we're not allowed to spend more money than what we're given. And so we don't want to have to put the program on pause or halt it and have it come to a pause and then recontinue the program if and when funds become available again, because this will create a huge frenzy and an influx in guys that are just holding on to coyotes until there's payment available. And then the last thing that goes along with this is requiring participants to submit within 1 year that they kill their coyote. And this is for two different reasons. The first is because it's hard to assess the program when you don't know how many coyotes are actually being killed, because guys are storing them up in their freezers for 2 or 3 or 4 years at a time. And then secondly, it would go along with being able to alter the payments. We don't want guys to hold on to because payments are only $40 this year and they might be more next year, and so, or in a couple of years, so they hold on to them until the payments are back up to $50, and requiring it to be within 1 year is going to force them to submit within one of two different fiscal years, and they won't know whether the payments will go up or down in the next fiscal, so it's worth it to just continuously turn them in a timely manner. And then another proposal we are recommending is the requirement of an electronic application to participate. So you can see on the left-hand side, it's kind of blurry on there, but it's our compensation forms that we require participants to fill out to submit coyotes. And it includes the method of take, the sex, the location, and the date of the kill on there. And so we would just be replacing that with the application, so guys would go in, download the application on a smartphone, and then they can submit through the application. It would require the same information, except for it'll no longer ask you for the app for the location information, because it'll request that you take a picture of the coyote, and it'll be geo-referenced and automatically uploaded to a database. If you're out of service, the application is capable of saving the entries, and then you can go back in and enter them when you have cell phone service. The reason we are wanting to shift from paper compensation forms to the application is because it'll make it more efficient and accurate for both the division and for participants. Participants currently, at least from my experience, most of them are going out in the field and they're removing coyotes, and they have to go back home, get on Google Maps or pull out a hard copy map and try to figure out where they were actually hunting at, because very few guys carry GPSs in the field. And so this is going to save them time where they don't have to go back and try to figure out where they were killing their coyotes at. And then on top of that, it's going to provide the ability to give us exact locations, which is really crucial for us to be able to assess how effective the program is for benefiting mule deer. And then for the division side, it also reduces the chance of having typos and being unable to read handwriting when we're sitting there and typing the information from the hard copy into the database. And so this just reduces any kind of errors, and it also makes it more efficient because nobody's going to have to waste time entering these forms because everything will automatically be uploaded. And then to go along with that, I know that there was some pretty big concerns revolving around hunters and trappers' locations where they remove coyotes and being able to protect where they're hunting and trapping at. And so currently the rule protects trapping locations. However, we want to extend that out to protect hunting locations as well. And currently, in our annual reports, we provide maps that look like the upper left-hand corner there, where we actually plot all the points for the coyote removals across the state each year. And we're going to shift that over to density maps, so that way guys will feel more comfortable with submitting accurate locations and not giving away their hunting holes, essentially, or their trap lines. And thank you. And do you guys have questions?
Thank you. Right. Take it back to Rat for any questions.
I have one question, Jayla. Yeah. So is there any concern that you're discriminating against maybe age classes by requiring this app? Like, I looked it up, and only 42% of people over 65 have a smartphone.
So that's been a really big topic for discussion, and we've gone back and forth about it. But realistically, we're not preventing guys from going out and shooting coyotes. They can do that as much as they want. This is a program where we're paying people to do it, and so we feel that they should be able to meet the requirements that we're asking of them in order to get paid. I mean, if you want to go out and shoot coyotes, you're more than welcome to do so.
Okay, John?
Is the application built?
Yeah, and so I forgot to mention, we're going to be making it available this year in July, and so we'll do a trial run and not require it until 2019, which will then give participants an opportunity to get used to the program and kind of work out all the bugs and make it a little bit smoother transition.
Okay.
Was it built from funds from the Navy of Protection Act?
No, I'm not sure on that. Do you know, Darren?
What we did is we have some folks that are pretty smart within the division. They use an off-the-shelf ESRI, you know, or ESRI is the geo-referencing company that looks at that. So essentially it was free software, and the guys get paid anyway. So no, it didn't come out of the fund. It kind of came out of the normal working budget. Yeah.
Any other questions? Turn over to the public. Any questions? Okay. Go on to comments. I don't have any comment cards.
Oh, sure.
Mr. Bear, Troy.
Troy Justice in Sports Division Wildlife. We're huge advocates of this program. Yeah, we are fully aware of why we're to this point. You know, we're paying for a lot of Nevada coyotes, a lot of Arizona coyotes, whatever. This has been a heated discussion amongst, you know, guys that hunt these coyotes for a living. One question they had is, you know, did the division consider a random lie detector test on some of these guys that are turning in multiple, I'm being serious, multiple dogs, because there has been some rather large infractions as far as people, you know, cheating the system. But as a whole, SFW supports the divisions and these recommendations. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. Lennon Pritchard.
Waylon Pritchard, I think this is a fantastic idea. It's keeping up with modern technology. Like she mentioned earlier, a lot of hunters don't carry a GPS with them. I know I don't. I think the basic cheap model that you can get, $150, $200. Everybody for the most part, almost everybody has a smartphone. With the use of that app to be able to mark the location of the kill, online being able to register with a COR, I think that's a great idea. I think that's going to get more people involved in the program. I know with the current system that's used now of having to come in, do the paperwork, register, I know it's kind of hindered me from doing the program a little bit. I think going with the paperless program and making it all on a phone, I think it's going to make it a lot easier, possibly get more people into the program. And also, like they mentioned, the privacy, hunting privacy, I think that's a great idea. I know a lot of coyote hunters, and they don't want to give out their location of where they go. I believe all that information is available that other people can get online, and instead of going out and doing the homework themselves and figuring out the area, they'll get online and look and see where people are killing coyotes, and that's where they'll start and that's where they'll go. Again, in all, I think everything's a great idea, and some great changes to the program.
All right, thank you. All right, that's all the comment cards I have. Take it back to the rack for discussion or motion. Yeah.
I think it's great that the division's clamping down on some of this stuff. If you sit down and think, this money comes from the Utah people, and to be paying for a coyote out of some other state is not right. And so I'm happy to see this take place. And I would like to make a proposal that we accept the division's recommendation as presented.
All right, thanks, Tim. You got a motion? Second.
EJ. There you go.
All right. Any other discussion? All right. All in favor? All right. It's unanimous. Thank you. Motion passes. All right.
Move on to Mineral Mountain Bighorn Sheep Management Plan, David Smedley.
Just drag all this stuff.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm David Smedley. I'm a wildlife biologist out of the southern region in Miller and Beaver County. I'm here to present our proposed management plan for desert bighorn sheep on the Mineral Mountains. I give you a little bit of background in our process through as we've created this plan. So we first met with the Beaver County Commissioners, most of the Mineral Mountain ranges within Beaver County. So we met with them, discussed reintroducing bighorn sheep to the mountain range, and we had some overall support from them. They had some minor concerns that we've addressed, and but overall we had support from the commissioners. We've coordinated with the BLM throughout this process. We have support from the BLM. And with the BLM, we've also met with them and with the permittees. We met with the permittees. We presented a draft unit plan. We gathered their input, and then we took their input and updated our plan to try to address their concern and use their input within the management plan. Then we presented that updated plan to both the Miller County Commissioners and the Beaver County Commissioners. And that was in August last year. So, and once again, we had support and interest expressed from those counties. Following that, we met again with the local stakeholders and permittees and just presented the plan to them again and showed them how we've updated it and discussed that and other wildlife-related issues. So the Mineral Mountains, give you an idea of location. It's in southern Utah, located between, I guess the east side of it. It's west of I-15, located between Beaver and Milford cities. So we modeled over 100,000 acres of suitable bighorn sheep habitat, and the great thing about the minerals, most of that is on public land, the majority of it. So here's a map of the modeled habitat. The black is the outline, what the proposed unit boundary would be. The habitat really is right along the mountain range, and then it's just flats on the outside edges there. The star is where potentially we would like to release them, around Granite Peak. So as I go through this is just kind of step-by-step through the management plan is how this is outlined and set up. So our unit management goals, like to manage for a healthy population of bighorn sheep. We like to balance their impacts with other uses such as the cattle grazing and then the local economies, and then we like to maintain a population that's sustainable within the available habitat within the unit. The issues and concerns that we addressed in the plan, first is potential habitat. Once again, we modeled the potential habitat and recognized there's a lot of habitat there, but there's still opportunities for improvement. Livestock competition was another concern. We discussed that there's really not a lot of dietary overlap, especially seasonally, with the use between sheep and cattle differ. Sheep typically avoid areas with cattle in general, especially as they're tied to kind of escape terrain and use those steep areas that cattle don't use as well. And then the deserts really have minimal water requirements. They don't drink a lot of water. Disease is another issue, with pneumonia. Spatial separation would be a concern there. And then predation. Really, the cougars would be the major predator here that we would be concerned with. So our population management, we'd like to achieve a population of 175 desert bighorn sheep within the unit. Our strategies for this, we'd like to start with a minimum of 40 sheep that will either come from Zion, likely, or the Muddy Mountains, depending on their availability at the time. Monitoring, we'll use GPS collars when we first capture the sheep and release them. We'll use aerial monitoring every 2 to 3 years, and then we'll also do ground classification. And then predator management, to kind of help address that concern, we'll coordinate any predator removal before the transplant with wildlife services. Our disease management objectives, I'd like to maintain that a healthy population of bighorn sheep and then maintain the spatial separation from domestic sheep and goats. Our strategies for these objectives, So when we first capture sheep, we'll test the initial source herd, and then we use opportunistic testing once they're released to try to make change and make sure that they're still a clean herd. And then spatial separation will identify areas of risk or concern. There'll be areas that we'll watch for as sheep after they're established. And then if necessary, we can go out and remove those bighorns. And then we've also looked at potential fencing to help reduce or limit the potential conflict with domestics. Our habitat management objectives: maintain or improve sufficient habitat to achieve our population. I would like to support and encourage regulated livestock grazing, and then enhance the forage production through range improvements. And then we'd also improve other habitat and water availability where possible. Our strategies for this will monitor habitat and quality, quantity and quality, and then these habitat improvement projects and the water improvement projects. This is a list that has come up in discussions with the BLM and the local permittees that are on the range. This is the areas that we think can be improved in that. Our recreation management objectives, we'd like to provide hunting opportunities in accordance with the statewide plan, and then increase and expand viewing opportunities and increase public awareness. Our strategies for this, we'll recommend permits in accordance with the statewide plan. I'd like to use U-hunts if needed to help maintain that population objective. And then, once again, increase the viewing, increase awareness and expand viewing opportunities for the bighorn sheep on the minerals. Our next section is public involvement. Our objective here is we'd like to provide opportunities for local stakeholders and cooperative agencies to be involved with the management process, which we've done throughout this process and like to continue to do that. Strategies for this is, as we go through this plan and it comes time to be revised, once again, those agencies and stakeholders and permittees will be invited to take part in our decision-making process as this plan needs to be revised in the future. Our timeline for this is possibly as soon as this fall. So we'd like to get this through, and depending on source herd availability, it could happen as soon as the fall this year. So that's all I have for that. Thank you.
All right, RAC members, any questions? Nope. Okay, any questions from the public? Okay. All right, we're going to comments. Greg Bird.
Greg Bird, Utah Wild Sheep Foundation. We support the recommendation as presented by the division, and you know, this has been in process for several years, and we really support what they're doing and the efforts that's gone into this, and we really appreciate our partnership with the division, and we would really like to see this go through. Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Greg. All right, Troy. We ought to just give you a microphone.
You don't want to do that. No, I don't want to do that. Troy Justice in Sports Fish and Wildlife. It's really neat to see this finally come to fruition. This started with the local chapter of Sports Fish and Wildlife down in the Beaver chapter. It's been a long road. It's been a long process, you know, to talk with all the stakeholders and, you know, the community for the most part. And I know our chapter members down there are extremely excited to think of what the idea of having, you know, desert bighorn sheep on that mountain. We support the division's recommendation. We're willing to support it both with manpower, financial, and whatever it takes, you know, to get these sheep on the mountain this year. Quite frankly, they should have been on quite a long time ago. But to see it come to this point is truly gratifying. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. So the comments we have, let's take it back to the RAC for discussion or motion. Okay.
I think it's great that the division's taken an opportunity like this to increase the population of sheep and eventually increase the hunting of sheep, add another unit to it. And as such, I'd like to make a motion that we accept the division's proposal as presented.
Okay. Motion from Ken. Recommended by Ben. All right, all in favor? Unanimous. All right, thank you. That passes. Move on to proposed rule amendments, conservation sportsman permits. Kenny Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, RAC members, members of the public. I am Kenny Johnson, the Admin Services Chief in Salt Lake City. We will be talking about three things. So I guess I'm on the agenda as one item. It's three separate rules. Do we just want to tackle them one at a time?
Yeah, let's do them one at a time.
Okay. Sounds good. So we're proposing changes to help streamline some of the internal processes of our reporting of expenditures in the conservation permit program. For those unfamiliar with the program, the Wildlife Board approves a small amount of permits, generally 5%, to be auctioned to generate revenue to fund wildlife conservation activities. The funding is divided between the organization offering the permit for sale and the division, with 30% of the proceeds going direct to the division, 10% of the proceeds to be utilized by the organization to cover administrative costs, and 60% retained by the organization to be spent on division-approved projects, as Justin and others have alluded to thus far tonight in their presentations. The Wildlife Board has kind of challenged us to find ways to report the positive impacts of these dollars in a more straightforward manner, and we feel these proposed changes will help us accomplish this task. So first off, we're proposing to strike an old vague section of rule that allowed groups to propose an alternate way to distribute conservation permits. Our intent is to clarify that they be distributed initially through auction to the high bidder. We also want to clarify that there can only be one statewide conservation permit per species. And third, if we have more than one rifle season for the same species, the conservation permit holder must select a single season. They don't automatically get both rifle seasons. So maybe a better way to say that is if the permit is specified as a multi-season, so archery, muzzleloader, rifle permit, the conservation permit holder could hunt all three of those seasons, but if there's multiple rifle seasons, they have to choose one and designate one of the rifle groups. Moving forward, we propose that all interest earned on the 60% of retained revenue be required for use on projects. So we want that returned to the ground for projects. That conservation funds committed to approved projects must be remitted to the division within 60 days of invoice. I didn't advance my slide. There we go. Within 60 days of invoice instead of 90. And third, that retained revenue be expended on approved projects were transferred to the division by September 1st, 2 years following the year it was collected. This is an important difference in what we're proposing moving forward. It's no longer tracked as committed and spent, just spent or actually transferred to the division. So that's an important distinction to draw tonight. All projects will be approved up front with a signed cover sheet. We'll invoice the group for the total to be used to complete the project, but we'll collect the funds within the 60 days as we're outlining here. The work will be scheduled and completed. This process will all be tracked and monitored in the division's database, which will allow us to show these funds being fully expended in our annual reports. And so this update really changes our work process a little bit and replaces the need for groups to provide redundant project details in an annual report. Moving on to some internal process updates with issuing and redeeming vouchers, we're developing some technology to help us better track and issue vouchers electronically.
This will prevent paper vouchers from being misplaced or delayed or ruined or need to be reprinted. Groups must now provide the division with the name of the number one.
I'll return, buddy.
Excuse me, thank you. So groups must now provide the division with the name of the successful bidder, the winning bid amount, and the date the event where the permit was auctioned within 10 days of the fundraising event. And the technology we're proposing will allow the groups to enter this a lot quicker and then give us a better idea of who the high bidder was and then those three key components to the auction itself. If the successful bidder elects not to use a permit opportunity, they can designate it to another person as long as the group is notified. The winning bid amount is not decreased, and an affidavit is signed verifying they're not profiting from the assignment. If assigned to another person, the group has 10 days to then submit a complete voucher receipt to the division with the updated information, and that would also happen through the technical system that we're proposing. Next, we propose to clarify that the division will not issue a conservation permit until the voucher information is received entirely, the recipient possesses a hunting or combination license, they pay the permit fee, and it's determined to, and the person is determined to be legally eligible to possess the permit. And that happens at our front counters. The provisions and process outlined in the preceding slides will also apply to the Antelope Island conservation permits as well. And finally, two items regarding some season dates that are in the conservation permit rule. We want to specify in the definition section that a conservation permit for turkey is not valid during the three-day youth-only general season hunt, unless the holder qualifies as a youth. If it's a youth who has the permit, they can hunt that extended youth date. And we propose changing the conservation bison permit season to August 1st to January 31st, and that's just to align it with other once-in-a-lifetime bison opportunities. Thank you.
All right, thanks, Kenny. Any questions, Murat? Ben, go ahead.
Kenny, can you go back to, I think it was your first slide. Right there. Bottom bullet point. I don't think we discussed this in our meeting last week, and this may already be answered here, where it says LA deer and elk. But will this impact conservation permits for bear at all? Where bear has any weapon seasons for spring, summer, fall?
Are we letting those conservation bear hunters hunt all three seasons now?
Yep.
In kind of the premium limited entry.
Yes.
Spirit?
And that would be a big detriment to that tag, I believe, to limit them to one of those seasons.
Then I would say likely not. I think, and Justin can help me maybe a little bit, I think the intent was if we have, you know, kind of the middle range dates for rifle hunts, mm-hmm. for deer and elk, that we don't just automatically give them the benefit of having those extra rifle hunts.
Yeah, so no, bear would continue to be multi-season. And I think especially as the bear hunts get more diverse, the multi-season makes even more sense with that. But on this, what we were trying to avoid was, it wasn't entirely clear on if they had to select this season or how that went, whether it's an early, mid, or late. And so now we're just saying they have to designate that.
And so the purchaser gets to choose the season. Okay, thank you.
All right, any other questions? Okay, any questions from the public? Okay, we'll move into the comments. portion? Sure.
I can use my alias name if you want me to. Troy Justice. Two things I want to point out here. Two is, the first is, who really deserves credit here? I know we as sports and groups get a lot of credit for it, but who really deserves the credit is the sportsmen in Utah. This is a sacrifice. It's 5% of the permits that are no longer available to them, in the hopes that we can generate monies to increase opportunity in the future in species. And there's no doubt that that's happened. We don't have the sheep program we have without it, conservation permits. We don't have the bison. We don't have the mountain goat. We don't have a lot of things. But hats off to Utah Sportsman for giving that sacrifice. You know, like I say, a lot of times groups get the credit, but the credit really goes to the sportsmen. Second of which is how important this program is. It is absolutely critical. If you look back at the video and the slides that Justin showed, we are a unique place with a unique program. Just recently we met as a conservation group, and I think what we raised, $3 some odd million we contributed, then you're going to match that. And the thing that really stood out to me in Justin's presentation is we treated close to 1.5 million acres. That's more than the rest of the states combined. That says something. And you look at the dollars we've raised. So we support the division's recommendation, anything we can do to continue to keep this transparent, to keep this program going. We support as a group, and we're grateful for the opportunity. Thank you.
Thanks, Troy. All right, that's all the comments. Josh, any comment cards anyway? So back to the rat for discussion or motion. Ben?
Throw a quick comment out there. Kind of echo what Troy said and give a shout out and thanks to Justin for the Wildlife Projects update that he gave us earlier that really highlights what this program has done. Like Troy, I've been fortunate to be involved in a lot of the funding of these projects and seeing where these projects are going is really exciting. I remember a few years ago, I think it might have been the first time I went to one of those allocation meetings, Greg Sheehan was giving the introduction of the meeting and made a comment about Idaho is getting ready to do a 4,000 acre project, which is a big project. And they were touting it as like this giant project, the big deal in Idaho. And then the comment was, we're going to do more than that today here in Utah. So just to point out how beneficial this program is to our wildlife, our habitat, and our sportsmen. With that, I'm not going to make a motion on this, and in fact, because of my position with Utah Earth Resources, I'm going to abstain on this item.
All right. Thank you, Ben. Ken, go ahead.
I'll make a motion that we accept the proposal as presented.
Okay. To be clear, we're just talking the conservation and sportsman's permit rule. Okay, do we have a second?
I'll second.
I think Scott.
All right.
All in favor? Okay, that's unanimous.
That passes.
With one abstention.
Yep.
Okay. One wildlife expo permit.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chairman. For those not familiar with the Expo Permit Program, it's a contract awarded in 5-year blocks with a renewal option for 5 years. So there's two primary purposes. One, to generate revenue to fund wildlife conservation activities in Utah and attract a regional or national wildlife expedition to Utah. As part of this program, the board authorizes up to 200 permits per year that are allocated to hunters through a drawing held at the Expo. An application handling fee of $5 per application is collected by the Expo organizer. 30% of these funds are required to be spent on division-approved projects. The remaining 70% must be spent on policy programs, projects, and personnel that support conservation initiatives in Utah. And all of these dollars currently are being spent in those regards. The majority of the rule amendments we'll talk about tonight came about from last time we awarded the contract. Some of the billing and expenditure concepts we just talked about for conservation permits will sound familiar as we go through the expo rule as well, as we streamline and standardize the billing and reporting processes here. Like all state agencies, when we contract with outside entities for services, we're required to follow state purchasing code. When the last contract was awarded, we worked to align state purchasing code with the timeline we had in the rule we're proposing to change tonight. It wasn't perfect, but to be clear, we absolutely followed state procurement code, and it's our intent to standardize the open noticed RFP process outlined in state purchasing code from this point forward. We're proposing to harmonize the expo contract application and renewal process to be consistent with state procurement code. This will ensure that all entities and qualified groups know the process up front, that it's the standard formal procurement process used for any contract you seek for services. We'd like to clarify that the division has authority to terminate the contract in interest of wildlife, wildlife or conservation management issues, or compliance with law. And third bullet, each year we field a handful of complaints from the public that some lucky individual drew multiple expo permits. We listen and we want to specify moving forward that if an expo permit applicant draws more than one permit for any species in the expo, that they would need to select a permit within 2 days, and they can only have one expo permit. Similar to the proposed changes we had to the conservation rule, in the interest of streamlining, as we discussed previously, we're proposing to require accrued interest on the application handling fee revenue dedicated to funding projects also be used for projects. Application handling fee revenue committed to approved projects must be remitted to the division within 60 days instead of 90, so we're streamlining that some. Application handling fee revenue dedicated to funding projects must be expended again on approved projects or transferred to the division by August 1st, so it's a month earlier, 2 years following the collection. And this will no longer be tracked again as committed and spent, just merely spent or transferred to the division. And again, this will allow us to zero these funds out annually and show the projects that they were used on. Invoicing for approved projects up front, monitoring the project expenditure detail. Again, we'll replace the need for the expo contractor to provide us redundant expo detail or project details to the division in the annual report. We already have that information in the database up front. Thank you.
Okay, we'll get back to the rep. Any questions? Any questions? Okay, from the public. Any questions? Jason.
Anyway, good to see you. Jason Hawkins here. I have a couple questions. I think I heard some of this, but we need to follow up on it. So I've got three questions. The first one deals with subsection 10 of the rule dealing with application revenues. It looks like the rule still allows the group to retain $3.50 of each $5 application for administrative expenses. I thought I heard you say, and I might have misheard, that the remainder, the other portion of that, or excuse me, the three, so $150 is used for projects. Is that right?
Correct.
30% is used for projects. Did you say that the 70% is used for programs, policies? Did I hear something along those
lines?
Yes.
Yes, committed to projects, policies, programs, and people for promoting conservation in Utah.
Is that in the rule somewhere? I was just trying to see where that was in subsection 10. Is that part of the rule, or where is that?
but it's a fair question.
And I was looking at subsection 10, so 60% 55 10 subsection 2. The conservation organization may retain a $350 of each $5 application fee for administrative expenses unless the organization pledges a greater percentage.
Right, so, yeah, just to be clear, the current contract is where we clarified that the $350 be spent for those additional items.
Okay. Was it, just on that same line, was there any thought from the division to put that requirement into the rule itself so that it would be in place for future contracts also?
I think we definitely have thought about that, but this would provide some... Any future expo contractor some flexibility with those funds to do things that are going to benefit wildlife into the future. I think we built in some flexibility with that concept.
Okay. I'll comment on the comment section. My second question is still in the same section. There was subsection 10, so we're still talking about application fee revenue. You mentioned in your report there used to be a subsection B there. Part of the annual report, so I'm looking at subsection 16, the annual report that's submitted by the conservation groups it addresses gross revenue, amount of the application fees kept for administrative purposes or expenses, that portion dedicated to funding projects, and there used to be a requirement that the report also include projects funded, a date of the funding, the amount undistributed, and the completion date for each project. I thought, like I said, you were speaking quickly, so I was trying to take notes here. I think you said the reason that requirement detailing the projects that have been funded from the $1.50 it's earmarked for conservation projects, that was redundant. Is that correct?
Correct. So we're changing the process to when those funds are committed to projects, we're just going to invoice the group for those funds up front and collect them and sweep them in the
house. So... In the past, the public had the benefit of seeing that annual report from the groups, and they could look and see what projects were funded and how much was spent, when the projects were funded and paid. How will that information be made available to the public now if it's not in the annual report?
That's a good question. So we'll still have the information. We'll have the funding. We'll have the invoices, the approved cover sheets, and all the projects that the funding was spent on. And so part of our annual review of this in the audit.
Okay.
We will cover that and disclose that information to the public.
So the DWR will provide it instead of the groups put it in the report.
Correct.
Okay. The last question I have is in 657-55-4, obtaining authority to distribute wildlife expo permits. I have been involved with this for several years. I think I've talked to you a couple times about it, Kenny. It looks to me when I saw these changes here, and you mentioned that part of the goal of this was to move over and be consistent with the Utah Procurement Code and to recognize a formal RFP process. Is that what the division's trying to accomplish here?
It is. Yes.
And so my thought on this, and what I wanted to ask you about is, that's the very process the division used back in 2015 and 2016 to award the last contract. And is there a reason the division didn't go through this process and amend its rule back in 2015 before it used the formal RFP process last time around?
Yeah, also a fair question. And as we worked through it a couple, 2.5, 3 years ago, it was kind of a timing issue. We started to work on the RFP, which we had explained to the groups at the time, in the spring, and then started to work with state purchasing, and it just took longer than we had hoped, and so it didn't quite overlap and align with what we had in rule. And so we just want to make sure and clarify moving forward that participants know this is going to be an open notice RFP through the Division of Purchasing.
So, essentially, we're going back 3 years later and amending the rule to allow the EWR to do what it did back in 2015.
Well, like I said, we tried to make it align the best we could at the time, and now we're just fixing it moving forward.
Thank you. Thanks, Jason. Any other questions? Move into the comment period.
can't quite read this. I think it says Troy.
Troy Justice in Sports and Fish and Wildlife, once again on this, as a participant in this program, truly grateful to be able to have those funds available and to use them towards bettering wildlife. We support the division's recommendations and anything to bring more clarity to this and to also inform the public where these funds are spent. We're a little bit unique as far as sports and fish and wildlife. We're not species specific. We cover everything from upland game, waterfowl, to big game. It was interesting this year as continuing to go through and to allocate some of these funds. You know, to date, about $500,000 we put back on the ground on projects or equipment to increase wildlife in this state. One of which is waterfowl, which doesn't have a large pool to draw from as far as revenue source. And it was interesting to me as I sat down with the waterfowl advisors here in the state, the money we put into waterfowl damn near tripled what they normally get through the normal process. Meaning, I believe their budget was $150,000. What we contributed through these expo permits, $5 application, nearly tripled it. It's a great advantage. It allows us, you know, with the conservation permits, they're species specific, or it's a big game to have to go to that. With these expo funds, it gives us the ability to go back in and invest in upland game, waterfowl, whatever it be. As president of Sports and Fish and Wildlife, these funds to me are sacred. I'll do everything in my power to be as transparent as we possibly can and to make sure those funds are spent in benefit of all Utah sportsmen. Thank you.
Okay. Any other comments?
Jason Hawkins again. I'm speaking just on behalf of myself. And Kenny, I appreciate you answering my questions. I've been following the Expo Tag program for about 10 years now. It's a program that's important to me, and I've been concerned about the same issues that Troy just spoke to about the transparency and accountability for public sportsmen. And there's two issues I'd like to raise right now on that. Number one, these are public tags. I like that Troy said these are sacred funds. These are tags that have been taken out of the draw. If you look at the purpose for these tags, it's spelled out in subsection 1, number 2. The purpose is for generating revenue to fund wildlife conservation activities in Utah and attracting a regional or national convention to an exposition in Utah. So the first purpose is to fund wildlife conservation activities. With that being said, I've harped on this, and I've been a bit of a broken record. I think more than 30% of the $5 application fee should be earmarked specifically for conservation projects. I don't think it's right that the groups keep 70% of the money for administrative expenses. And I know it costs money to put on the expo. I get all that, but I think 30% is just too low. We can do better than that. And if we're looking at wholesale changes to the rules, you ought to take a look at increasing that above 30%. The second point I wanted to raise, I touched on this with Kenny in my questions, is the DW already used a formal RFP process through the Division of Purchasing to award the last contract back in 2015 and 2016. I'm happy that we're here making these changes to authorize that process, but it should have happened 3 years ago. Administrative rules for the DWR have the binding effect of law. They don't just impact the public. The DWR, the agency, is supposed to be bound by their own rules. And if they wanted to use a formal RFP process 3 years ago, they should have taken the time to go through the process and amend their rule and send out public notice and get public comment from sportsmen to come in instead of just doing what they wanted to do and then coming back 3 years later in 2018 and making the changes to authorize what they've already done. And, you know, I don't mean to criticize Kenny for that. You're not responsible for that. You're the messenger, and so I'm not doing anything. But the point I'm trying to make is, we put the cart before the horse, and the public weren't provided an opportunity to come and comment on this in this process. And now it's already done, and we got a 5-year contract in place. And there's also a fairly recent amendment that you can extend that for another 5 years, and maybe 10 years before this comes back up again. And if you look at the rule that's being amended, they didn't follow the process that was authorized, and I don't think that's right. I'd just like to share that with you.
Thanks, Jason. Sure. Well, go ahead, Troy.
Just to what Jason pointed out, you know, he says 30%, but honestly, this year we'll be pushing 90-95%. The other thing to remember here, too, is we say these permits, this is an application fee, no different than what we paid at Fallon, Nevada when you apply. How much of that money from Fallon, Nevada comes back to Utah Wildlife? Zero. Right. We understand the benefit of this. We understand they're taking out of the normal draw. This provides another draw for people to participate. It has attracted one of the best shows. We built one of the best expos there is in the West. And it is a viable tool for putting a substantial amount of money back on the ground for Utah Wildlife. Thank you.
Okay. Bring back the wrap for discussion.
Just a couple number clarifications. There are a lot of percents thrown about. So you're saying 60% of what the organization puts on the expo is earmarked for that organization, but it's not earmarked for conservation or administrative, or just break down that, because that's a follow-up question on that.
So to clarify that, for the expo, 30% of those funds are used for division-approved projects. The other 70% are used for things related to conservation in Utah. And in the current contract, like Troy just mentioned, almost 100% of those funds are dedicated to conservation efforts in Utah.
We call it the Western Hunting and Conservation Expo, so putting on the expo is used for conservation, right? So I guess my question to Troy would be, how much does it cost to put on the expo itself? So when you say 90-95% are used for conservation, the administrative cost of the expo is essentially a conservation cost, right?
Sure.
Yeah.
Restate it again. What is it you're asking exactly?
I'm just trying to make sense of the gentleman here is asking for 30% to be earmarked for conservation, and you're saying 90-95% used in conservation. So is the cost of putting on the expo considered conservation, or is that considered administrative?
Well, I guess it depends on which side you're on and what you're looking at. The other thing to take into consideration, there's several revenue streams for the expo. This is just one of them.
Okay.
Yeah, you got the conservation permits on there, and then you have the $5 app. And the way the $5 app works is that it's $5 to apply. $1.50 of that is restricted. Okay, that has to go to be spent on a project that's approved by the division. You have a cover sheet. The other $3.50 is up to the discretion of the organization. And that has to go towards mission accomplishment and better wildlife here in the state of Utah. One thing we've done, now we have a partner in this, the Neilger Foundation is a partner. They track it differently than we do. I have a spreadsheet that goes here and tracks each project that we put that money through. To date right now, just guessing off the top of my head, it's over $500,000 that we've committed from this year to on-the-ground projects, whether it be big game, upland game, or waterfowl. And we plan on sharing that with the public, just like Jason said here, is having a spreadsheet to show when those funds are allocated and the project they're put towards. But, you know, to put on the expo, it's a lot of money. It's a ton of money. There is. Mm-hmm. Yeah, when we met here, I can count for every dime of it. That's, you know, something I've committed to going forward. Is just we'll be able to show and account for that money. Is there expense to put on? Sure, there is. It's a huge expense. Anybody that's been involved in it and knows, it's a substantial amount of money to pull off an event like we do there.
I've got one question for you, Troy. You're on the spot.
That's all right.
So you mentioned there's other revenue streams associated with the expo, and sometimes there's a concert, there's an entrance fee, there's concessions, there's a number of revenue streams associated with that. Is there a reason why
100% of the $5 fee couldn't go back to conservation in the earmark, considering those other revenue streams would likely cover and exceed your administrative expenses?
Well, you mean, the earmark 100% of it, I think, is a strong ask for the group. There's an expense that goes to it. There's a hard cost to even get, you know, to having this drawing for $5 app. Whether, you know, the drawing's done through a third party group that puts on that, there's a hard cost to that. There's the temporaries that added into that. There's a hard cost. So to be able to say, no, 100%, I don't think that would be fair to us as a group to ask. Like I said before, this is a little different than selling a conservation permit. This is a draw. Anybody has the opportunity to put in the draw. Like I pointed out before, no different than what you're doing in Fallon, Nevada. Zero money that Fallon money comes back here to the state.
Sure.
A large portion of here in the state goes for Utah Wildlife.
Well, like I said, I hate to put you on the spot.
No, that's fine. That's a fair question.
So you referenced the Fallon, Nevada, you know, the comparison there. They don't have any other, there's no other revenue streams associated with that process, whereas with the Expo, there is several other revenue streams. I think that's the differentiation where people might.
Well, Fallon, Nevada is for a profit. They're a business. They're not an Expo or whatever you type deal.
But we don't have any other revenue streams associated with the draw, just a $10 fee. With your Expo, so you've got entrance fees, you've got concessions, you've got booths that you sell, and all of those things. And so I think that's why the question comes up sometimes. Understanding there's an administrative cost, but why specifically? And you even mentioned this year, you know, 90-95% likely going to go back on the ground. So I think the question is, you know, why would you need any of that $5 fee?
Well, there's a cost to doing business. And in a perfect world, if I was king for a day, and I could create a endowment fund that where I could cover my overhead.
Well, I guess what I'm asking, Troy. I
mean, you bet I'd stand up and say 100% goes there. But the bottom line is this, is there's a cost to doing business.
Sure. Maybe I'm not asking the question clearly. What I'm asking is, did your other revenue streams cover the cost and then some of putting on the Expo?
Sure.
Chris, if I could point out also, this was part of the presentation that one of the reasons for the Expo tax is to draw an Expo here. And so I guess my take on that is that $350 is an incentive to an organization to bring their their Expo, their convention here, as opposed to, well, to get 100% back, then.
Well, right, but I think
that lessens the
Sure. I think the counter to that, though, is just being able to put on the Expo and having the tags there draws in a huge audience by itself.
Well, yeah, it does. Yeah, off the top of my head, I believe there's about 15,000 some odd people that applied for the permits this year. I'd have to look. But we had over 50,000 through the gate. So not everybody that comes participates in that $5 thing. So to say that's the only reason they come, you're wrong.
Right, but it is
and Mr.
a draw. It is a draw. There's no doubt. But does it make or break it? No, it does not.
Mr. Chairman, maybe just to clarify, it's a completely appropriate use of that 70% to cover things like the draw that they contract with Gray Sky and pay volunteers to do some of the overhead costs. That is completely appropriate use of those funds.
Sure. All right, thank you.
You bet.
Okay.
I just want to comment. I don't think it's fair to have Troy stand up here and defend himself. They've got the contract. They play by the rules that the division put in place at that time. If we want to change the rule, that's completely different.
I think Troy offered to answer any questions. All right, any other comments, motion?
I guess I just, it's a question of the division. So you say you want to get rid of redundancy from in the language communication. And I guess the issue you're really talking about is that
is that redundancy that's built in the system a good thing for public transparency, or does it really streamline the process in the ways that we hope? That you know, by doing well at the annual report, sure, the information's available, but now is it just buried on the website that maybe they've gone to? Or, you know, I'm just trying to understand if redundancy in this case is good, or if it's redundant and you've already got enough redundancy built into the redundancy.
Right. Let me clarify what we're trying to do. So the groups right now in an annual report have to provide project details with the funds that they use. And the proposal we've put in place is to kind of overhaul that process where they commit funds, and instead of having to wait months to tell us something in the annual report, as soon as they commit those funds and they're approved, but with a signed project cover sheet, we go ahead and invoice the group for the total of that project, and then they go ahead and transmit those funds directly to the division. So the reason I say that they're redundant is, since we have that information already timestamped in the database all along the process from start to finish, it's redundant for them to have to provide us that information. So the streamlining is actually the division database being able to display the funds and the projects and the timestamps. Does that help, Jeff?
Okay, do you have a motion? Okay. Move to accept the recommendations presented.
Ben, motion from Ben, seconded by George. Any further discussion? Have a vote. All in favor? Everybody but Josh. All opposed. One opposed. Motion passes. Thank you, Tim.
And one more. Don't blink on this one, it's quick. So, draw application procedures. We're proposing to copy the current rule, which outlines waiting periods in the expo rule, so in R-657-55, over to the draw application procedure rule. So this will consolidate a few more permit types into this one rule location. And so really what that means is we'll clarify that if you draw a limited entry or premium limited entry expo permit, you can still apply in the division draw and the expo draw. There is no waiting period. If you draw a once-in-a-lifetime permit at the expo, then you are done putting it in the Utah draw, is essentially what that says. So we're just moving it from the expo rule over to the draw application procedure rule. And then just a couple of consistency changes. We would like to standardize the requirement for a hunter to possess a valid hunting or combination license in order to apply for sandhill, crane, sharp-tailed grouse, greater sage grouse, and swan permits. To this point, they haven't needed one to apply, and we just want to make that standard across the board for all of our dogs. And then lastly there, ensure group applications consisting of only qualifying youth for turkey, sandhill crane, sharp-tailed grouse, and greater sage grouse. If you apply as a group and it's all qualified youth, that you get considered for the increased opportunity that youth get, just like deer and other opportunities we have. So it standardizes that to make sure youth are actually counted for youth, and lets them apply in groups of up to four. And that is all on that one.
All right, thank you. All right, move back to the rack for any questions. Perfect. Any questions from the public? Any comments? Bring back to the rack for a discussion if necessary. Dan, go ahead.
Move to accept as recommended, as presented.
Okay. Ten motions. You got a second? 10 seconds. Ken? Ben made the motion.
Yeah, Ben and Ken.
All right. All in favor? That is unanimous. All right, thanks, Kenny. Bring back to Marty. He's got his videos queued up. So. Marty, do you feel like this could be handled in one fell swoop, or should we take these one at a time?
One fell swoop.
All right, excellent. Great answer.
I thought that might be what you wanted to hear. Again, Marty Bushman with the Utah Attorney General's Office here to present to you changes to four different rules. They all involve the same basic substantive issue, and which is basically this past year we at the Department of Natural Resources got some attention on other boards and councils within the department that weren't complying with the Open and Public Meetings Act strictly. The Wildlife Board, the RACS, the division got through that just fine. We were doing a good job there. But that episode caused us to kind of go through and re-look at all of the different committees and councils and working groups that we have in the division and try to make a reassessment of whether they are potentially subject to the Open and Public Meetings Act. And that's the act that requires us to post agendas and go through this process that you're all so familiar with and have minutes and so forth and record meetings. And in that process, we identified four different committees or groups that were potentially subject to the Open Meeting Act solely by the fact alone that they were created and ruled. But none of them were ever really intended to function as a public body like this RAC does. In fact, they deal with issues that are more individual in nature, not policy-oriented like the Wildlife Board and the RAC does. And so we're proposing to basically strike those committees in rule. And the first one deals with the collection, importation, transportation, and possession of animals rule. The committee's the Certification Review Committee. The Air Remedy rule dealing with the Air Committee. Yep. Amphibian and reptile, collection, importation, transportation, possession rule. Again, that's the same Certification Review Committee. Recreational lease of private lands and free public walking access rule. That's the Walking Access Advisory Committee. And lastly, the Division Variance Rule and the Variance Committee. And I'll go through these briefly to kind of give you this little background of what they are. The Certification Review Committee operates in two different forms. One's dealing with the possession and importation and transportation of reptiles and amphibians. The other is all other animal species. It is staffed by rule by representatives from Wildlife Resources, Department of Agriculture and Food, and Department of Health. The committee makes recommendations to the Wildlife Board on three different types of things, and they're all recommendations to the Wildlife Board. One is petitions to reclassify species as to whether they'll be authorized for possession or not. The other is to approve variance requests for prohibited species. Many of you may be familiar with that. People that want to possess or import a prohibited species have to get a variance. And then lastly, they make recommendations on appeals to COR denials. Under these amendments, the committee would be struck from the rule and the responsibilities would be assumed by the Division of Wildlife Resources in consultation with the Department of Agriculture and Food and the Department of Health, so that we'd still have the same partners and process, just trying to remove this thing from this committee from arguably being a public body and going through public meeting forums and they're dealing with matters such as should somebody get a variance, for a baby kangaroo or some other animal. The next committee is the Air Committee. It operates under 65750. It's staffed solely by Division of Wildlife Resource representatives. And the committee makes recommendations to the division director on complaints seeking relief from division heirs in the processing and issuing of wildlife documents. Again, very individualized situations with people who had some error occur in the process and they're looking for some relief. The responsibilities would be assumed by the division. The director would still make the decision on that. the Lothian Access Committee operates under R657-56, staffed by representatives from wildlife, sportsman interest groups, agriculture interest groups, and elected officials. The committee makes recommendations to the division director on complaints concerning the fair and equitable treatment of people participating in the Lothian Access Program. Of note, the committee never organized and never met. There's the belief that it really probably doesn't need to exist anymore, but to the extent it does, those responsibilities that were formerly the committee would be seen by the division. The variance committee, it's this one staffed by DWR representatives. It makes recommendations to the division director on remedial release sought by people that are substantially precluded from obtaining or using a wildlife document because of some event or condition, injury, illness that they've had in their life. And those responsibilities will be seen by the division as well. And that concludes those proposed rule changes.
Oh, sweet.
We like.
All right. Any questions? Any rat? No? Okay. Any questions from the public? All right. I don't have any comment cards. Opting out of this.
Troy, Troy. You have anything to say?
All right, bring it back to the rack for a motion or discussion. Yeah, go ahead, Josh.
6573, is that all exotic species? Or no?
Yeah, it's virtually every animal you can think of that's not an insect or an acrid.
Is that
good? Excluding reptiles and amphibians, which are covered by another rule.
Yeah, sorry. Is that the better matter in the committee or ever?
Oh, yeah. All it functions. And it's not super frequently, but a few times a year.
So, what's the, I guess, the rationale for that?
The rationale is it's largely dealing with individual cases of people wanting species and that, which aren't really suited for public meetings. It was never a committee that was intended to have to keep minutes and an agenda and post it and record meetings and all of that. And it was one we really felt would work better in a format that's, I mean, those who are involved with it can certainly come. It's just not generally open to the public.
Hey, we have more discussion or a motion?
Move to approve as presented.
All right, Brock. It's a motion. AJ seconds. Okay, let's vote. All in favor? That's unanimous. Thanks, Martin.
Thank you.
That concludes our meeting. Thank you, everybody, for coming tonight. See you next time.